folks. Rob Wolf here. Greg Everett in the house. This is episode 173 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. And Greg, belated happy birthday, brother.
Thank you, sir.
How was it? Are you older, wiser, stronger, better looking, or had you maxed all that stuff out already?
Definitely maxed out my good looks many years ago, but I definitely know I'm getting older now, because after a couple days out of the gym, it's probably the first time I can remember I didn't really want to come back. I wasn't really itching to get back into my office, so...
Shocker.
Aside from that, it's pretty much all the same.
Yeah, the first vacation that we took in 5 years, when we went to Little Corn Island in Nicaragua, and we were waiting for the Ponga to go take us back, I actually cried on the dock. It's like, no, I don't want to go back. But I made it back and everything's okay. So cool. Anything else new? Anything exciting?
Nothing more exciting than doing this podcast right now.
Indeed. There is no doubt about that. Let's see here. Show sponsors. We've got frontdeskhq.com. FrontDeskHQ is your mobile solution for service-based businesses, CrossFit gyms, Pilates, yoga, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, MMA, dog walking, stroller striding, you name it. FrontDeskHQ can take payments, point of sale. It's just kind of the bee's knees. So
maybe we should clarify too that it's not only mobile.
It's not only mobile, but that's kind of the gee whiz factor to it, is that using your mobile device of choice, you can run your whole operation with like an iPhone, an iPad. I believe that they will be Android and those other, you know, dubious systems will be up and running at a very near future as well. But that's kind of the cool gig, where normally you would have like a sign-in kiosk for like a CrossFit gym or something like that. At least, for the love of God, I hope you've at least got that much going on. But whether you do or don't, you can do all that stuff. Track everybody's comings and goings, take photos of people, you know, to populate your class list. This is how you can pay your trainers. It's pretty slick.
Pretty awesome. We're looking forward to getting on board with that whole thing.
We just got NorCal onboarded this weekend, and so we test ran our gym so that if it nuked everybody's data, we were the only ones who would probably get killed in that. But we imported all the data from the other service we were using previously, and everything seems to be motoring along pretty well so far. So we haven't like triple billed people or anything like that. So that's cool. Who else do we have? Evolve Foods. Go to evolvefoods.com. Buy some food. We have an affiliate program back, so I'll be able to get you guys some super snazzy discounts. So if you want to wait until I've got that going, then you can do that. Who else do we have? Performance Menu.
Yes.
How the hell did I almost forget the Performance Menu, Greg?
You know what? I almost forgot it myself.
That's okay. Performancemenu.com, the Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence. You get 12 free back issues when you sign up. Food, training, humor, life stories, it's all in there. If you take your training and coaching at all seriously, you've got to sign up for the Performance Menu. It makes a great gift as well. Don't forget that. Indeed.
Everybody loves a good gift.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's Anything give else? The gift of podcasts.
Let's give the gift of done.
Yeah.
Let's get this thing done.
Okay. Olive oil adulteration. This was one of the alternative episodes of Popeye.
That's an interesting direction, too. That's an interesting direction, too. But I was just imagining some kind of, you know, hair-thinning, cheesy-looking guy driving with a somewhat outdated muscle car and, you know, cruising around with olive oil and, like, trying to get the hookup with people by winning them over with his prize-winning olive oil.
That's so much more complicated than mine.
Yeah, you are
just thinking on a whole nother level.
Well, if you call it thinking, then I'm good with that. So
okay. Cool. Jeff says, Rob and Greg, really, what good things are there left to say about you two and your work that haven't already been said? Rather than pile on with effusive praise, I'll keep it simple. You two are great at what you do. Thanks. My questions are equally simple. Is the adulteration of olive oil a legit health concern, or just more tinfoil hat scaremongering? If I can't get to know a local olive farmer, how can I best assure myself that the olive oil I'm eating is the real deal? Are USDA certified organic olive oils less likely to be adulterated than non-certified oils?
Oh man, you know, the whole situation kind of sucks. Like I'm not a huge food labeling advocate in some ways, because I think that just opens up a whole other layer of regulation and kind of goofy stuff. But that said, if the label says olive oil, then fuck, you should be able to assume that it's olive oil and not canola and peanut and this and that and the other. And it's really, God, it's just annoying. So is it dangerous? It's dangerous to the degree that normally olive oil being very predominantly a monounsaturated fat is typically pretty shelf stable. It's usually loaded with phenolics and other antioxidants, and so that helps its shelf stability also. If it's in an opaque jar, or at least a darkened jar, or maybe like a, you know, full-on Italian style where it's in like your Unabomber jug kind of, you know, can, then that's better, because you don't get the light in there and you get the chain propagative lipid peroxides and all that stuff from UV exposure going in there. But the stuff should be reasonably shelf stable, and the stuff that is commonly being sold when we get these other high polyunsaturated fat containing items like canola oil, they aren't shelf stable. They don't impart any appreciable antioxidants to the scene. Maybe they add a little bit of vitamin E to it to try to help with that. But you know, is it going to kill you dead? No. Is somebody who's already, you know, inflamed and hyperinsulinemic and everything, and then they throw some shitty quality olive oil on their salad, is that doing them the favor that they thought it was? No. And so it would be nice to figure out, a couple of sources of some stuff that's really good. I've had some stuff. Nikki is friends with her childhood family friends own a place in outside of Red Bluff, and I am blanking on the name.
Outside of Red Bluff?
Yeah, it's not Farm Star, but it's because that's the pizza joint in Chico. I'm completely blanking on the name, but this stuff.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and now it's driving me crazy.
Yeah, and the olive oil itself is you can't see through it. It looks like the stuff from Reanimator that they inject into people. It literally is almost fluorescent. It's beautiful, and I've had this stuff right out of the spigot after the
Lodestar Farms.
Lodestar Farms, good on you. Good. I knew there was a
some star kind of in there. Star.
Lodestar Farms. So Google that, check it out. I can guarantee that those guys are 100% legit. It's pricey, but at the same time, unless you're doing a masking kind of deal, you don't necessarily need to be like shotgunning this stuff by the glassful. But like I was saying, I had this stuff straight out of the spigot, and then I had some that had been in a bottle for like a year, the opaque bottle and all this stuff. And the difference was noticeable, but it wasn't huge. And then I tried some, you know, kind of high-ish quality stuff that you would get at like a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods or what have you. And it tasted like swill by comparison. And, I'm not an olive oil schnob, but I guess I am. We try to buy more stuff along like that Lodestar Farms kind of quality. The stuff's opaque. It hasn't been filtered. Just calling the people and asking them, hey, is this stuff legit? And you're going to pay more money for it. You might have to have it shipped in. But that's one way to really be assured that the stuff is solid. But at the end of the day, you know, if you go in and buy some Trader Joe's olive oil, their Greek olive oil or whatever, and maybe it's adulterated, maybe it's not. I have no idea. Don't sue me, Trader Joe's. I have no freaking idea. Why don't you tell us if it is or not? But if it is, I don't think it's going to be the end of the world, but it's just annoying on kind of like a food, you know, credibility, like transparency kind of gig that it's even a question.
It's a little irritating.
Yeah. I mean, not irritating like, you know, surfing and getting a bunch of sand in your fanny crack or something. I mean, that's really irritating.
Depends on what you're doing with the olive oil, I suppose.
Mm. Yellow oil could help them for sure.
Okay. Diet Coke and bone density. Kate says, hi, Rob and Greg. Is Diet Coke paleo? Just kidding, that's not my question, but it is about diet soda. Growing up, my mom was always dieting, meaning eating less food, mainly crackers and Cheerios, and as a result, only had diet sodas in the house. In middle school, I got into the habit of drinking diet sodas daily. Since they didn't have any calories, my mom and I didn't mind. So started a 12-year-ish complete addiction to Diet Coke. I've been eating about 80-20 paleo for around a year to great success, and have just recently managed to get rid of Diet Coke. I know many others who are in my boat. They've got the food down, but not the diet drinks. I've heard that diet soda causes bone demineralization, so here's my question. I'm now 24, and bone development is supposed to peak at 25 and start going downhill, I think. Are my bones compromised from all my years of drinking diet soda? What should I prioritize now to make sure I don't deflate when my bones spontaneously dissolve in a few years? I wish I had no bones! Should I convince a doctor to check my current bone density? Is there something I should eat more of or an exercise I should do more of? I hope an answer to these questions will help other ladies and gents who have similar pasts with diet soda. Thanks so much for all you guys do. I have listened to every podcast, though I can't claim to understand all of it. Thanks. Neither can I.
Yeah, we can make no claim to that either. So, digging around the literature on this, it's kind of funny in the kind of alkaline diet nut jobber kind of scenes, they will mention soda being bad because it has phosphoric acid or phosphorus in it, and that can create phosphoric acid in the body, and that'll leach calcium from the bones, and this is the same reason why we shouldn't eat meat, and we should, you know, juice and all this stuff, and the science behind this stuff is just terrible. This is one of the things that originally we were kind of touting a benefit of the paleo diet because you ate all these fruits and vegetables and it would have a net alkalinizing effect. And, clearly there are benefits to getting minerals and there's benefits to getting antioxidants and all that sort of stuff. But the acid-base dynamics of the body are really, really complex. And typically they're only looking at the renal element of this. They're not looking at the fact that we can displace pounds of acid-base load via dissolved or displaced carbon dioxide in the body and the whole bicarbonate, system. And that was always something in the back of my head when I would look at this stuff. I'm like, so are we hooking people up to, some sort of respiratory gig and checking out, how much carbon dioxide they blow off? And clearly we're not. And so this is a long roundabout way of saying I'm just really dubious as to all of the acid base stuff and the alkaline stuff. It's just really hard to get a foothold on any of that with any degree of credibility. I do think that to the degree that we get some sort of acidotic or metabolic acidosis, it's a consequence of insulin resistance and shifting into a largely glycolytic state where we're just taking glucose and converting it down to pyruvate or lactate. And I think that could produce some chronic net acid load on the system instead of using the kind of full mitochondrial complex to pump things through the TCA cycle, Krebs cycle, whatever. But all of that, and so that background, which sounds completely nutcase at this point, but in digging around on PubMed and elsewhere, about the best that I've been able to divine out of that is that when people drink soda in general and diet soda, it falls in that, is that they are typically displacing things like milk and orange juice and things like that. And so particularly with the milk, you get the calcium out of it. And so if you're not getting that calcium, then it may create some problems elsewhere. In paleo land, we tend to get a lot of calcium out of nuts and seeds, and fruit. And then also people kind of forget bone broth and eating the cartilage off of, chicken wings and eating the sardine bones and all that sort of jive. If you are totally averse to all that stuff, then maybe you should have some Greek yogurt or something here and there to prop up the calcium a little bit. Definitely making sure that your vitamin D levels are adequate. And, if you've been listening to all the podcasts, then you know that I'm having a waffling waffler moment on should we get vitamin D from supplements, or should you even go in and get like some tanning booth time in lieu of kind of oral supplementation gigs. So lift weights, do some sprints, stay mobile, keep your vitamin D level good, keep your protein intake good. get mineral balance from lots of fruits and veggies, some nuts and seeds, and you should be great on that. And certainly getting a baseline of your bone mineral density doesn't seem like a bad idea at all. Like if you are really behind the eight ball on that, let's say that you are actually are osteoporotic, osteopenic, then you would really want to get motivated about eating very, very well, really aggressively tackling some weight-bearing exercise and, making sure your vitamin D is good and mineral status is good, both calcium and magnesium, because we have examples of people in advanced age reversing osteoporosis with weight-bearing exercise and a non-inflammatory diet. So some of that stuff that is commonly touted, I think, is kind of bogus. But you don't really know till you track something.
Okay.
Sweet.
Breakfast, fasting, and circadian rhythm. That sounds like some kind of new age album title.
I was going to say it sounds kind of music-y.
Elaine says, do you know of any research on, or do you have some thoughts about, the role of breakfast in normalizing one's circadian rhythms? Maybe I'm not searching the right terms, but consensus seems split between skipping breakfast, intermittent fasting style, and eating breakfast immediately, leptin reset style, when it comes to getting your sleep-wake habits back on track. Do each of these approaches normalize a different sleep problem, or is food less important to circadian rhythms than light therapy? My intonation was just horrible on this one. One mouse study is quoted a lot by popular media, supporting the idea that fasting for 12 to 16 hours before breakfast in a new time zone may help you overcome jet lag faster. As always, thanks for being awesome.
It's a good slew of many, many questions in here.
Not it.
You know, if you have somebody who's metabolically broken, there's maybe two ways that we could tackle this, and that is like that meat and nuts breakfast, the leptin reset deal where you do 30 to 50 grams of protein right out of the gate within 30 minutes of waking. That it seems really effective for a lot of people just because they're definitely not hungry later. It seems to set the day at a good clip from there. Other people clearly benefit from doing a little bit of fasting, like whether they do a little bit of training in a fasted state, whether they just seem to fire mentally a little bit better when they're in a fasted state. And I think that there are examples of both. If you have somebody that's very, very stressed out and high cortisol, I think that fasting is a bad idea just across the board. Like we maybe even start doing something like four meals a day and a snack. Like we're keeping blood sugar levels way more consistent because the peaks and troughs tend to really irritate that whole adrenal fatigue, adrenal burnout kind of story. Then as they get healthy, we dial them down to like three meals. Humans aren't cows. We shouldn't be grazing throughout the day unless you're Steve Pan and that's what you do. So, there's just different ways of skinning the cat, I guess. And depending on what you have going on, there might be, some benefit. This is where it just gets so damn specific, like needing to look at what's the lifestyle of the person? How are they kind of wired up? Like, are they a really type A kind of wound tight kind of person? Are they more relaxed? One thing out of all of this, it does seem like partitioning more of the carbs towards the bedtime, towards the dinnertime meal, seems to be beneficial both with regards to sleep and with regards to body composition. So it seems kind of safe, regardless of what else you're doing, that partitioning more of the carbs later in the evening seems to have some benefit for the body comp and suppressing cortisol and kind of getting the body into a wound down, parasympathetic, healing, restoration kind of mode. So that seems solid. But the rest of this stuff, like whether you should fast in the AM versus doing like a meat and nuts, protein and fat kind of breakfast, I think that a lot of that is just very individual, your makeup, your schedule, your current needs, and then we could probably make an educated decision on that.
Okay. Rob, go ahead, go get something to drink and eat, and I'll finish this question in about 20 minutes.
Sweet.
Look, feel, perform versus long-term health. David says, hello, Paleolithians. I'm a powerlifting and strongman competitor who has reaped the benefits of the paleo diet over the last 8 months. I had no major health issues prior to starting the diet, though I did have depression slash anxiety episodes. My motivation for starting the diet was to perform better, but it has had the added bonus of improving my depression and anxiety symptoms too. I did a few months of strict paleo before I started tinkering. My observations thus far are, 1. I have no noticeable reaction to dairy other than the very occasional bit of acne, though I'm not 100% sure the dairy causes this. 2. Sugar is fine in moderation. If I go overboard, I get some acne and it messes with my sleep. 3. Rice has no noticeable effects whatsoever. 4. Trace amounts of gluten have no noticeable effects, but the time I ate a whole pizza, it messed my shit up. Literally.
Shocking.
Yes. Using these observations, I'm quite happily making informed food decisions, well aware of what the consequences they may have on me. That was odd. Generally, I'll have some dairy, usually cheese, 3 to 4 times per week, some chocolate, sweets, ice cream once per week, and rice 3 to 4 times per week when I'm trying to gain weight. I learned the lesson with the pizza, so I stay well clear of any major gluten sources, but I'm not worried about foods that may contain a small amount of gluten. The above diet has me looking, feeling, and performing fantastic. Couldn't wish for more. My question relates to my long-term health. If I look, feel, and perform well on a not-quite paleo diet, am I more at risk to food-induced diseases than if I were on a strict paleo diet? I guess your answer is going to be yes, to a degree. I seem to remember on a previous podcast, you, or Cordain, estimated that the paleo diet may add 10 to 15 years to the life of someone who would otherwise be on a standard American diet. If someone is looking, feeling, and performing top-notch, how close does that person come to getting that 10 to 15 extra years? Is my eating ice cream once a week for the next 50 years going to cost me 2 years? By my math, that means each time I eat ice cream, I will sacrifice 6 hours, 44 minutes, and 18 seconds of my life. Sounds worth it to me. Especially if you're eating that ice cream for 6 hours, 44 minutes.
Seriously, yeah.
Okay, scrap the above questions. How about you guys just do a general ramble about how many seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years of your life you'd sacrifice each time you ate your favorite non-paleo food if they didn't have any negative health impacts on you? Go. Sorry for the rambling question. Sorry for the rambling question. I'll add more. Oh, man.
Yes. So what did we do with this one?
I don't remember this at all.
So, I remember talking to Lauren Cordain. I think we were doing the Paleo Brands seminar back in San Diego ages ago now. And we were just kind of talking, and he made the observation that when you look at the known and suspected health consequences of eating gluten, that in general, like take the United States, if we could get everybody gluten-free, you would probably add 8 to 10 years of life to these people. Boom, right out of the gate. Just you know, gut inflammation, cardiovascular inflammation, neurological inflammation, allergies, on and on and on. Like all the inflammatory characteristics of wheat and gluten-containing items are impactful enough on health that you could make a pretty good argument that if we mitigated that stuff, we would take our average lifespan from like 75 years up to, 85, and let's just say 85 years. And then we could make a further argument that if we tighten things up along this paleo or ancestral health template where we get vitamin D from the sun, we get lots of fruits and vegetables, we have lean meat that has tons of nutrients in it, and ideally it's grass-fed, so we get like conjugated linoleic acid, and we get iodine from seafood, and on and on and on, that we might stick another 5 or 10 years onto the top end. And so we'd go from like 75 years to like 95 years as the average. And when you look at some places like Okinawa and Sardinia, they don't eat a paleo diet specifically, but there's some elements that are pretty similar there, even though the Sardinians eat higher fat, it's mainly monounsaturated fat and all that sort of jive. And so, then I guess the real question here is, each time you do the hookers and cocaine binge, what's that costing you? And it's really hard to tell. We have a question coming up here later on the whole hormetic stressor kind of story. And I could make an argument that every once in a while, like some ice cream and nachos binge is could be a beneficial hormetic stressor. And to some degree, I think that this is where, there's kind of conflicting information on alcohol consumption. Alcohol is a known carcinogen. It's not great for insulin sensitivity. It's got all kinds of other problems, but it also decreases stress, and it decreases stress, you know, it both because it's kind of a sedative, but also because we do it in a social fashion. And so there's, you know, behavioral stuff associated with alcohol consumption. So, you know, if every once in a while you go out with a bunch of friends and you guys totally kick your heels up and try to destroy like an all-you-can-eat dessert buffet or something like that, there may actually be some benefit there just because you have a good time and you bust each other's balls doing the gig. You know, I mean, there's so many other layers to this stuff just beyond like protein, carb, fat, and hormesis and all the, you know, all that sort of stuff. There's all the socialization and the rest of our life that we live. So I think it's hard to...
So wait, sitting on the couch crying and eating ice cream and drinking whiskey doesn't count?
Doing that would probably, each dose probably takes like a year off your life. So, but so, I mean, I don't know. Like there used to be something going around that like each cigarette somebody smoked that took 6 minutes off their life or something like that.
That sounds like one of those weird made up things with the tobacco propaganda fucking thing.
I know. You know, so clearly I need to Snopes that one and see what the real deal is. So I, you know, at the end of the day, my main deal, as always, is I think that out of any of this stuff, I think the most gnarly thing that we face is gluten. And so, you know, last week we had somebody come and watch Zoe, and Nikki and I went out for dinner for the first time in like 8 months. And I had a gluten-free pizza at this place called BJ's, and it was amazing. And I didn't decommission a bathroom afterwards. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I had a cider with it. I had a little bit of bloat just because that was a pretty good-sized carb bolus for me. But I got up the next day. I felt fine. I had a good roll at Jits. Everything was cool. If I ate like that every day, I would have horrible body composition. I'd feel like crap. But, you know, just for that once... You know, once a month, once every 2 months for me, you know, if I'm going to do something like a pizza, then I'm just going to do a gluten-free pizza because they're pretty damn good now. Out of any of this stuff, I still consistently, if there's any one thing that, you know, really seems to impact health in a gnarly and large number of ways, it's gluten. And so if you can find alternatives to it, then that seems great. And one of the things to keep in mind too is it seems like people will go from kind of sub acute, you know, gluten intolerance, and then as they get older, they get under more stress or their training volume increases, then they get more gluten sensitive. You know, they react to it more. So it's a bit of a moving target just because the level of reactivity you have today is a certain, you know, say like a 2 out of 10. It's not to say that it couldn't be a 8 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10 down the road if circumstances change.
Yeah. Indeed. Okay. Paleo and cancer. Dawn says, I've just finished chemo and have done 5 out of 33 radiation treatments. My husband and I started paleo 4 weeks ago and we are loving it. He's lost 9 pounds and me 4. I was diagnosed when 25 weeks pregnant, so I'm also holding on to some baby fat. Although the weight loss is awesome, my intention of doing this, quote, diet, it will be a way of life for me, is for the health reasons. What caused my breast cancer? I am inclined to think what man has done to our environment and our food. With knowing that, I hope I can articulate my questions correctly. I believe in a little cheat every once in a while. I love eating healthy and can do so without much yearning for the bad stuff, but every so often it is nice. I love to cook, love food, love good beer, etc. So, what is your thought on cheating and possibly fueling more cancer? I think I'm getting all worked up and maybe for no reason. We went to dinner yesterday and I had a steak with grilled mush and onions. That makes it sound gross. But I got a salad with their house dressing, warm bacon, and ate 2 small pieces of cheese bread. That was my first bread in 4 weeks. I didn't cheat horrible, but wondering if even something that little is bad for someone like me, someone who has a history of cancer. Am I making sense? Yes.
Yes, you are. Probably much more sense than we are going to make on this. Squatchy definitely has a thematic flair. Got to give that guy continuing props. So.
He just has these incredible flows from questions.
Indeed. So, you know, one thing that would be interesting to know is if this was,
I don't want to say legit breast cancer, but if there's a tendency in the oncology scene to take a situation called ductal carcinoma in situ DCIS and to call it breast cancer. Now, what this is, are some precancerous cells that have the potential to go bad, to go worse, but they also, it's a little bit similar to early stages of prostate cancer where the stuff can cook and ferment for decades and do nothing. It comes in, it goes away, the immune system clears it. Is there a potential there it could do something? Yeah. But you also have the potential of just having 100% normal tissue, something happens, and then it's metastatic stage 4 breast cancer a couple of years later. So there's just potential all over the board there. And so one of the questions I would be interested in knowing is exactly what flavor of cancer this was. In general, breast, colon, prostate, astrocyte brain tumors, glioblastomas, these types of cancers are very responsive to growth factors like insulin and hyperinsulinemia, insulin-like growth factor, we would get out of dairy. All of them are derived from the same embryological tissue, and so they tend to have very similar responses to androgens and growth factors. And so with all that in mind, I could make an argument for being a little bit on the ketogenic side, at least a week out of each month or a month out of each quarter or something like that, just as a means of keeping the kind of growth signaling on the low end with stuff like this. It's not fully in the genre of what Tom Seyfried from Boston University, who has done extensive research on cancer and ketosis, he recommends that we would need to do like a ketogenic, calorie-restricted or fasted state scenario for anywhere, like fasting for a week per year or calorie restriction plus ketosis for a month or longer per year, and like gnarly calorie restriction, like a 1,100 calories, like not very pleasant. I think it'd almost be easier to fast for the week than eat that skinny for the month. But the idea with this stuff is, again, like a hormetic stressor, causing a challenge on potential cancerous precancerous tissues that are glucose dependent and gluconeogenic substrate dependent from amino acids, and that this would kind of press a system reset so that we clear some of these cancer cells or precancer cells by limiting the substrates it uses as fuel, and then also by just kind of firing up the immune system, because the immune system kind of goes into high alert during these times. So I could make an argument for being a little bit ketogenic at least once in a while if you've got a family history of cancer or you've gone through a bout of this. From there, like what type of shenanigans can you get away with? Again, it's really, really hard to say, what are your vitamin D levels? What's your activity level? Is your sleep absolutely bulletproof? Like, are you going to bed at like 8:30 each night, pitch black room, sleeping 10 hours, waking up totally refreshed and everything's good? I think if you've got that going on you've got work that you love, you've got a great family life, you got awesome social support, like you're Mary freaking Poppins everything's great.
Minus the spoonful of sugar.
Minus the spoonful of sugar. Well, then in that case, maybe you can get away with a spoonful of sugar.
Not a serving spoon either.
Yeah. Yeah. Not something you would serve military rations with for sure. But, but on the other side of that, you're really stressed out. You're type A. You have low vitamin D. You're shackled to a desk all the time. God, it's sounding like Greg and I.
You're describing my life right now.
I need to go do a breast and a prostate exam on myself here. So the other side of this, super stressed out, not good sleep, challenging work environment, and challenging not in like the gee whiz, I jump out of bed to go, do my work because it's exciting, but like wow, I would crawl into a manhole cover and not come out if I could do it, versus going to work. So I think again, all of these lifestyle factors, all of these other epigenetic factors
are really important in considering what you've got going on. The more stressed you are, the more your sleep is impacted, the less social support you have. And by social support, I mean like friends and family and people that you interact with on a daily basis. The more impacted you are on all those other areas, I think you have to be tighter on the food side, or the potential for problems increases. It's a multifactorial, you know, kind of problem. And I think that that's where this evolutionary biology template is really, really powerful, because we don't just look at food. It's not just the zone. It's not just Atkins. It's this integrated approach, trying to look at the full kind of genetic life history of an organism, in this case, us, and try to figure out like what are the optimums, you know, getting good sleep, getting good exercise, getting some vitamin D from sun exposure, having lots of meaningful social interaction, and then eating a diet that is on, you know, typically more in line with what our evolution and our genetics would kind of recommend than not. And then that makes the occasional heel kickups not that big a deal. But again, with the caveat, like the two small pieces of cheese bread, I mean, if that's absolutely a deal breaker for you, like, it's cheese bread, you know, give me cheese bread or give me death kind of gig, then, then by all means do the cheese bread. But it's another one of these pieces of the puzzle that I feel like there are so many other options that doesn't involve the gluten, doesn't involve the potential GI irritation and all of the other systemic inflammatory issues, that I'm just hard pressed to be very flexible on that. Again, it's your self-experimentation. You do what you do. If you do fine on it, then, you know, great. But we see so much stuff and so much new stuff on the gluten and the connection between gluten and a variety of pathologies, that it just seems really easy to make an argument to not have that be part of the hookers and cocaine binge. There's so many other things that you could do.
Cool. You know, I can go on to the other things you can do with hookers and cocaine.
You know, nachos and ice cream and dark chocolate. And I think, you know, we have and then gluten-free options.
Slow Nikki down. I'm trying to write them all down.
Nikki makes these grain-free chocolate chip cookies. And it's almond flour and butter. And then we get like these 85 or 90% dark chocolate chip cookies. And they have so much butter in them that you really can't eat them warm, because it's like scraping fresh, you know, a dog excrement out of your lawn or something. It just has a not satisfying a texture then. But you throw it in the refrigerator and chill them, and they're amazing. They're totally amazing. And she'll make those every once in a while, and they're phenomenal. I'll dunk them in some decaf espresso, and they taste delicious. It seems like we have so many other really cool options floating around that it doesn't seem super compelling if you've got control over your environment. And we've got a couple of questions from people coming up next that are in the military, and they have way less control over their environment. So we need to be a little more flexible. But us folks living at home in the States, or, you know, any type of westernized country, typically you've got so many options before you. I don't know. Again, I don't want it to be cultish, but I see so many people do so well cutting the gluten out that I'm just remiss to really give anybody a, you know, stamp of approval on that. It's like, fuck yeah, light it up. Smoke it, snort it, do whatever you want. Take gluten from every orifice. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, so many restaurants now have like entire gluten-free menus, or at least like a few things to choose from. So if you're going to kick your heels up, always check that for an option first.
Yeah.
Before you go want to, you know, gluten freak out. Okay. Paleo in Kuwait. Pam says, good afternoon from Kuwait. I just arrived here 3 weeks ago with the military, and I'm having a tough time eating paleo. That's weird. I know the basics, but my issues are finding good healthy fats, and I'm about tired of a grilled chicken breast. Even the eggs are powdered, so I opt for egg whites, which are probably processed as well. Although I'm able to get my workouts in, I'm feeling yucky from not getting the nutrients that my body needs. Any ideas, tips, or meal supplements that I can try without paying out the you-know-what for being shipped to Kuwait? Thanks.
Man. You know, people have sent folks care packages with, like, nuts and coconut oil. I would be willing to bet that if you went to the kitchen that you could probably get your hands on some butter.
and you know, just like a brick oat butter. And if you have a refrigerator in your barracks, then you could throw that in there. It sounds kind of wacky, but you literally just like, you finish a regular meal that's maybe a little skinny on fats and good fats, and you just go in and carve off a hunk of it, gnaw on it, and it actually tastes pretty damn good. They probably have some whole manufacturing cream, so you could use some whole manufacturing cream. It's just kind of hard, you know. Locally, you might be able to get some red palm oil. You might be able to get some coconut oil. Might be able to get some coconut products. It's really interesting. I know that stuff is produced in those areas, but it's like when we've been to Nicaragua, the only coffee that is sold in Nicaragua is like the worst quality stuff you've ever seen, because they literally export all of the good stuff. Like, there is nothing good that you can really find in country, and it may be a little bit similar there. So those would be the ideas. Try to get the family to send you a care package with a bunch of almonds or you know, whatever nut you like, maybe some coconut oil on that shipment. Like, who is it? Tropical Tradition sells like the 5-gallon thing of coconut oil, and you know, it's probably a little bit pricey to ship it over there, but you just drop a spoon in that and go to town, and you're pretty good for at least a 6-month deployment, I think, even really digging in on that stuff. Trying to find some butter or some whole cream from the kitchen, and then trying to see what the local kind of shopkeeper scene is there in Kuwait. And I suspect you can find some red palm oil, might be able to find some coconut oil, coconut products, and possibly some olive oil.
Cool. Let's see here. Hormesis. Everyone loves a good hormesis question.
It's not chili.
Oh, man, I want some chili now. David says, I've heard a lot of paleo folk talk about minimizing toxins in their daily life, almost to the point where it seems like they're trying to live in a clean room. Yes. While I appreciate wanting to nourish the body, is there a value in hormesis? The Greeks believed that exposing oneself to toxins or physical damage in some way could be beneficial, i.e. whatever doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. I thought that was the Germans. Nietzsche is the one who said that, isn't he?
Something like that.
And then he died from like stomach problems. With that in mind, how much should we really be concerned about toxins in our modern environment? Doesn't our body have coping mechanisms to adjust and become more adept at handling toxins over time, i.e. cytochrome P450 enzyme? Thanks for everything you do. Love the podcast. You guys rock. This was also demonstrated in the film The Princess Bride.
That's true. Too true. Phenomenal movie, too. One of the best ever made. I mean, this hormesis gig, you know, getting punctuated exposures to challenges, I think that it clearly, this is a really beneficial thing for humans, pretty much anything alive. I remember as a kid, there were some studies that it was like in the Funk and Wagnalls Big Book of Science, you know, or something like that. I remember this thing, it showed a plant that was outside and it had temperature changes and exposure to bugs and everything, and it looked a little beat up. And then there was a plant that was indoors, and but it had some fluctuations in temperature, and sometimes it went without water and stuff like that, and it looked really good. And then there was a plant that was 100% protected from like temperature change, predation, and the plant ended up dying. And I think that you know, it's almost like we're a signal processing reservoir, you know, like living stuff. It processes the signals from the environment, and that's part of what keeps the organism alive. If you cut off all the signals, then the kind of patterning of the organism kind of drifts, and it loses the ability to survive, literally. And so, yeah, I mean, trying to overly protect yourself, I guess, is kind of goofy, but the hormetic stressors that we know are kind of good, like limiting macronutrients at various times, like having some periods of time where your protein intake is lower, where your carb intake is lower. You know, there's some protein recycling, there's some cellular autophagy that's good with all that stuff. But then that said, we know that exercise is really powerful for unlocking the same type of hormetic stress response in the cellular autophagy. So go lift some weights and do some sprinting, and you get kind of the same effect from, you know, protein cycling and carbohydrate cycling, you know, barring
over consuming calories, which at the end of the day, all of the the theories about insulin modulation and all the rest of that stuff, I think clearly, like Chris Masterjohn's talk that he gave at AHS 2012, it was really good. And I talked about this in part three of my thoughts on low carb and paleo. If you guys haven't read that 3-part series, you definitely need to do it. But you know, he makes the point that most of what we would attribute to metabolic derangement is overconsumption of calories in general, which initially causes, interestingly, kind of an oxidative stress response, because the body tries to upregulate its metabolic processes. It enacts uncoupling proteins in the mitochondria, which basically allows free radicals, electrons, to just kind of spill out into the environment. And this causes a lot of heat. There's a lot of heat generation, not much work generation, not much ATP manufacture. And this is a coping mechanism to deal with too much a stress of too much food. But over time, what happens is the individual becomes insulin resistant. In an attempt to take nutrients, and instead of pumping them through any mitochondria, they're stored in adipose tissue. It's a way of just kind of walling this stuff off and storing it. But obviously, that has some negative health consequences. So, I had like a zillion thoughts on this. And another thing, I was working on some research related to inflammation and different disease processes, and I was kind of thinking, you know, if cardiovascular disease is an inflammatory process, I bet we see worse allergies in people with cardiovascular disease. Or maybe you could make the argument that people with lots of allergies tend to have greater rates of cardiovascular disease, you know, depending on which side of the coin you look at. So a little bit of quick PubMed searching, and I found a slew of stuff. And it's correlative. It's not, you know, a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized, crossover, gold standard study, but it's just intriguing that in the literature there's a clear relationship between elevated frequent allergies and elevated likelihood of cardiovascular disease. And when we view this whole thing from the picture of a systemic inflammatory response, and that response could either be on the innate immune system or on the adaptive immune system, typically resulting more in autoimmune type stuff, innate immune system responses more like allergies, metabolic derangement, gut permeability and stuff like that. But when we view this from a big picture perspective, and any type of chronic inflammation is going to be problematic for damn near any organ system that you could think of, then, you know, it starts making an argument. The original question is, should we minimize toxins? So what are those toxins? Like, should you not sniff gasoline? Probably. You know, should you, again, with all the ones that we've talked about today, should you try to avoid gluten? Yeah, I would make a really strong argument for that. Like, I think it is clear that gluten is at play in gallbladder disorder, a host of these gut-related systemic inflammatory issues ranging from autism to cardiovascular disease, thyroid dysregulation, and on and on and on. So could we make a really solid argument for avoiding gluten as a toxicant? Yes, I think that's pretty safe. Even things like green vegetables, you know, like salad greens or some of the, you know, more wild rustic stuff like mustard greens and chard and stuff like that. If those things get too big, if the leaves get too big, the amount of oxalates in the leaves gets very, very high, and you could cause kidney failure, kidney damage from consuming plants that have a really, really high oxalate content. So that's a toxicant that we would probably want to avoid, you know? So all of these things have thresholds of reactivity. And again, you know, like vitamin D status, sleep status, what type of shape you're in, you know, all of these things are going to feed into how you respond to things. Your genetics and the epigenetics, you know, are going to feed into how you respond to this stuff. So, I'm all about embracing things like a dip in cold water, spending some time in a sauna, exercising. Maybe a little bit of intermittent fasting, again, with the caveat that we are not under a ton of stress, that our sleep isn't disturbed, that we're not doing Fran followed by Helen followed by Diane in a fasted state, you know, for super hard charging athletes, like fasting should be used very, very sparingly, very targeted. Like maybe you use it on testing day when you're doing anaerobic interval type stuff or something so that your GI tract is empty and you have no issues with shunting blood away from the digestive tract and muscles. So,
well, so now what about, aside from, you know, food-based toxins and that sort of kind of physical toxins, what about stuff like, you know, bacteria? Because I think, to me, that's more what he had in mind with, like, all these, the generation of Clorox kids whose moms, soak them in Lysol 6 times a day and probably have the adaptive immune systems of, like, a 50-year AIDS patient. What's your thoughts based on that stuff?
I think that stuff is silly. And, you know, like each time we go to Whole Foods, they have the little canister of wipes out there and everybody judiciously wipes their card off. And now I hate
just hilarious because half of them don't shower.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, they roll around with like a dust storm, like pig pen around them anyway, that smells of patchouli and rank hippie. So yeah, it you know, I think that people are generally doing themselves a huge disservice by hyper cleansing themselves and particularly their kids. Now that said, when I go on an airplane, I do wish that I might even start wearing like one of these little mini HEPA filter things, because I don't get sick every time I go on a plane, but typically when I'm traveling, I have some sort of like a speaking engagement gig, and there's a lot of handshaking and hanging out with people late nights, usually not as good a food as normal. And it like the potential for me to get sick is just greater. I get sick more often when I'm on the road, but so barring really extreme things like that, I think that people are really doing themselves and their kids a disservice by hyper cleansing everything. Like when Zoe, we take her to a little park down the street from where we're at, and it's pretty cool. It's got like a rubberized surface and all this stuff to crawl around on and everything. And there's rocks and dirt, and she sticks it. Of course, the only thing she wants to play with is whatever's stuck in the crevice, of the playground equipment and everything. And I just don't sweat it. Like, I'm not super paranoid about washing her hands. We were just in NorCal this last weekend, and she crawled all over the gym floor and everything. And I washed her hands off of that because, I mean, she literally looked like she had, like, you know, soot black on her or something. But it wasn't this deal where I every 10 minutes I was pulling out some sort of, like, a sani wipe deal and trying to mop her down. I know for a fact from the literature and just kind of I guess a little bit of faith in this kind of evolutionary biology model that a kid who's exposed to some immune challenge is going to be way healthier. They have less likelihood of asthma. They have less likelihood of cancer. They just tend to be healthier. And so I think that, you know, being, you know, trying to avoid, you know, like it's stuff like plasticizers, you know, like heating up your food in some 1980s Tupperware, probably not a good idea, you know,
like the stuff that gets all warped when you take it out and it's half melted into your food.
Your scrambled eggs are now orange because of transferred plasticizers and stuff. Like, that's a horrible idea. I think when you repaint your house, get new carpet, I think getting some stuff that has a low, what do they call it, VOC, like volatile outgassing something and others, you know, basically it's not outgassing a bunch of really gnarly stuff, which a lot of those are like xenoestrogens and they're toxic and all the rest of that. I think that doing some stuff like that to minimize your toxicant load is not a bad idea. I don't think there's any real, you know, downside to doing stuff like that. I think it's more environmentally sound, both on the big scale and on the smaller scale. So I think some stuff like that are legit, but yeah, you're pointing that out to me is good. I think that people are definitely doing their kids a disservice being hyper vigilant on the hygiene side. You know, kids are meant to be dirty. They need to play in tepid, you know, standing water and get a gut pathogen every once in a while and harden the fuck up from that stuff. You know, it'll be good for them.
Seriously,
honestly, it'll
maybe
be good for
kick them off the fucking couch for a minute and go have them roll around in some dirt. They wouldn't be such whiny pussies.
One could dare to dream, you know. It's interesting now that, you know, there's enough CrossFit gyms around and there are enough people who've had kids in these gyms
it's interesting to me, like, these kids almost seem like a different species than, like, the rest of the population. Like, my nephew Caden, he's 4 years old, and he can kick up into a handstand and cruise around on his hands, and really amazing balance, sharp as a whip, and you know, and he's a kid. He can get tired and annoying and stuff like that, just like any kid can. But he's
any human.
Yeah, just like any human. But he's a really solid kid. And then we see the other kids in the gym and some of the stuff they can do. Like Caden, 4 years old, just like with dead sprint this weekend, jumped, probably cleared a good 2 or 3 foot gap, which is, you know, considering he's 2 feet tall, you know, it's like, you know, his body length kind of good. Jumped and grabbed a gymnastics ring that was low, you know, down in his grasping range with one hand, and then swung one-handed. And I was like, I was thinking that would be a not insignificant task for me to, like, jump, you know, cover a 5 foot gap, catch the ring at the end of the 5 foot gap one-handed, and then maintain my grip. Like, I know I could do it, but it would give me a pause. I would run through that in my head before doing it, you know? And, this kid, it was just nothing for him, you know? And this is getting onto a whole other, you know, side topic, but, you know, the fact that we don't have, playground equipment, and, you know, or the playground equipment now is just so weenified, you know, there's nothing.
It's freaking just a goddamn shame.
There's no, just jungle gym bars, you know,
so you can break it from one thing to another. Burned, like, you can't do anything cool.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to, like, hang your fellow kids, like, from their shoelaces. I mean, it's just, it's bullshit.
Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of stuff like that where, so I think David's question is interesting. Like, you're kind of onto something. Like, are we over protecting ourselves? And I would say in some ways, yes, you know, like trying to hyper sanitize everything, trying to make every, you know, playground, so, you know, 100% safe. If it's 100% safe, then it's 100% useless. You know, occasionally some kid is going to get hurt, oftentimes catastrophically, but it's a 1 in a million, a 1 in a 2 million thing. And it's horrible, horrible. But then the rest of our kids, the rest of our society are kind of paying the price for trying to guarantee 100% safety. And so, you know, you've got those two ends of the spectrum, but then you've got this middle ground where I do think that we live in a little bit of a toxic environment, lots of xenoestrogens, lots of plasticizers, bad food as a baseline, you know, all that sort of jive. But I think that, you know, trying to be a little bit hardy and you know, adaptable, I think that that's really solid.
Cool.
It seems obvious, but, you know, it when you cruise around the rest of the world, it clearly is not, you know, at least the West, you know, a lot of the United States.
Yes. All right, well, we got to do this one because it says it's urgent. Should probably have a thing on your contact form that says, if this is an emergency, please close the browser down and dial 911.
Dial 911, yeah.
Okay, Mike says, insert praise about the vast wealth of knowledge I have received since I found your podcast here. But really, thanks for what you do. I'm a service member and I'm being deployed to Africa in about a month. My military doctor has given me doxycycline to take for the duration of my deployment, 6 months, to ward off malaria. It seems like a smart idea to not get malaria. However, I know that the doxycycline is going to wreak havoc on my gut. I've been paleo for a while now, and I feel like I have just gotten my gut under control as I have had candida and other gut issues. I've listened to almost all your podcasts, and I plan on consuming some gluten-containing products before the deployment so that I do not have as serious gut issues while in theater. However, would you suggest taking the malaria pills? If so, should I take something else to mitigate the damage to my gut? Should I maybe keep an eye on malaria symptoms and take the doxycycline if I think I may have it? Do you know of any other alternatives to the doxycycline? I know that you are not a doctor, and I am not requesting medical advice, but any help that you can offer would be much appreciated. Thank you again.
I'm glad he had the exculpatory clause in there, so that's cool. You know, there are some other anti-malarials, but all of them are pretty gnarly. The doxycycline isn't great, but it, you know, the problem with taking it post-script, what the doxycycline does is it prevents the plasmodium, the organism, the parasite from replicating. And so you're going to be way too far down the line
I mean, unless, because you don't always know when you get a mosquito bite. So, you know, if you're just like, okay, if I get a mosquito bite, then I'll start taking it. If you're in an area where they really suspect this stuff, then the likelihood of getting a mosquito bite is pretty high. You have two different varieties of malaria. One of them is a pretty good bet it's going to kill you dead. The other one, you're going to have a real high fever and be miserable for a while, but you're probably going to live, particularly, you know, if you've got modern medical support. But it's a gnarly adventure doing that. Like, I just, wow. Yeah. The humans have a lot of different interesting adaptations to malaria that we've developed in the course of like 5,000 to 8,000 years, because it's such a selection pressure on us. So it's a really gnarly bug. You could take some Saccharomyces boulardii. Jarrow Formulas has that. If you've had yeast issues in the past, then you could be taking that with the doxycycline, and that should help mitigate the likelihood of a yeast overgrowth issue. Saccharomyces is a beneficial yeast, and it should help displace other things like candida. Generally good eats. I forget if doxycycline is it increases photosensitivity, so you'd want to look into that. And I'm also unclear if it has impact on the pathway of vitamin D manufacture. So even if you're kind of relying on some sunlight to make vitamin D, I'm unclear if doxycycline is in that amoxicillin family. I guess I could do some Googling on that, but I'm I don't know, my keyboard is out of reach right now, so I'll leave that up to you to do some Googling on that. But those are all some things to keep in mind. I think a probiotic is probably going to be challenging to track down on deployment in Africa. If you could find any type of fermented food that you trust, then you could give that a whirl. But, you know, otherwise, I think that in the grand scheme of things, you know, avoiding malaria is probably your big deal. The second deal is trying to minimize the likelihood of getting some sort of a yeast overgrowth again, which I think the Saccharomyces boulardii would be a good option with that. And that stuff's heat stable, so you don't need to refrigerate it. You could buy 4, 5, 6 bottles of S. boulardii from Jarrow Foods, and you should be good to go. And then it's just, you know, eat as well as you can, sleep as well as you can, do the investigating on doxycycline and photoreactivity and also vitamin D production, just so that if it does interrupt vitamin D production, then that's a legit argument for making sure that you've got some liquid vitamin D drops, like from Carlson's or something like that.
Sweet. All right. Well, this one's already over, so let's just wrap it up with one more.
Sweet. Why not?
Dan says, hey, Rob, I was listening to episode 73, and you were responding to a letter about someone getting their gallbladder removed, and you guys were joking about insulin tans. Oh, man. Or tyrosinase reaction. Tyrosinase? You tell me, Rob.
It should be tyrosinase. And so this is where Dan heard one thing, but it kind of rattled into his noggin differently. But it should be tyrosinase.
Oh, interesting.
It's an enzyme. Yeah, oh, right. Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
This one made it sound like some like proper possessive amino acid.
Nope.
Okay. Well, I'm 27 years old, and I've had, quote, age spots, liver spots, sun spots, at least since high school. I was told they were sun damage, and that's generally all I find online. But I think that's bogus because I barely have them on my arms or face, mostly on my back, stomach, and chest. Also, I live in Vancouver, BC, so there's really not any sun to cause any damage. My father is covered in them, more so than anyone I've ever seen. His back is basically one liver spot. Do I have any chance here to turn this around, or am I destined to become one large liver spot? My father is also a sugar addict, eats lots of bread and butter, drinks only Coke or lemonade. Another background for me is that I've been aware that I have candida since maybe 2008, but I may have had gut flora issues earlier than that. I often get red burning eyes, which I was told could be a result of my liver, maybe from processing toxins from candida. I also have had skin problems, sensitive flushing skin, keratosis pilaris on arms, and dry skin on my face. All of these things have gotten much better but are still present. I've been following paleo loosely since 2011, still drink milk, have cheese, sugar, and grains occasionally. That's pretty loose. I take a multivitamin and probiotic, vitamin D and cod liver oil, and vitamin C. My question is, could you elaborate more on, remind me again what it was?
Tyrosinase.
There you go. So tyrosinase. I'll change this in the notes.
The show notes.
Okay, curious cool. Nace reaction, and maybe offer an idea of what's going on with me. And could you offer any advice on foods to avoid and some foods slash supplements that may be able to help with slowing down the liver spotting? And I guess more importantly, helping my liver function, if that's an issue. Thanks.
Woo. So...
yeah, I mean, they call them liver spots, but the tyrosinase reaction is a Browning reaction, and it's kind of funny. It ranges from, you know, browning toast to, you know, the stuff going sideways in your forehead and getting a giant, nasty liver spot. And, you know, oxidative stress is really the biggie here. And so if your POPS is this reactive... I'm just kind of picturing like the super pasty, like Irish guy or something that, you know, does just eats a super pro-inflammatory diet. The fact that you suspect some candida, you know, you're feeling better, but stuff's still kind of loose, I would tighten that stuff up, man. I mean, it's another one of those things where tighten it up till you get really healthy and then figure out what type of shenanigans you can get away with. Like, it seems like you're still in this kind of middle ground that is not doing you too many favors. Really high sugary foods, pro-inflammatory foods, gut irritants, low vitamin D level, bad sleep, on and on and on. Broken freaking record. You know, it's kind of all the same stuff. Antioxidant rich foods. So like if you're training hard and you need some carbs, doing like some yams or some purple sweet potatoes, which are really antioxidant rich, versus like white rice, I think that you're going to get better results off that. Just based off the accompanying antioxidants that you're getting out of that story. Depending on your insulin sensitivity, we could maybe argue bringing you down a little bit in total carbohydrates, needing a little bit more monounsaturated fats, maybe some grass-fed butter, getting iron status checked, because if your ferritin level and iron saturation levels are very high, that is a very potent prooxidant. And so, it's interesting. Whenever we start seeing any type of common oxidative stress, and maybe this is an argument for another flowchart that I could put together with Amber, but when we start thinking oxidative stress, you know, we can think about gut permeability, we can think about low vitamin D levels, we can think about iron overload, poor sleep, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all the same culprits, but it's interesting that they all kind of converge they have overlap. The effects are not localized, you know, which is why we keep saying systemic inflammation. But if we have high iron status, then it means we're in a pro-oxidative state, which means the likelihood of this tyrosinase activity is greater. And then we also are likely to be insulin resistant, which elevates blood glucose, which increases the likelihood of this tyrosinase reaction. So it all starts kind of jamming together, and when you look at people who are suffering from these problems, they've got multiple pieces that are broken that need to get fixed, or the situation's going to get much, much worse.
Well, what do you know?
That's all I've got on that. No matter what else Squatchy put in here, we're done.
Yeah, we're done. If Rob says we're done, then we're done.
We're done. We're out.
All right.
Anything else? Can you think of anything else that people need to be aware of?
Nope.
That's succinct. Perfect.
That's it.
All right, man. Well, again, happy birthday.
Yeah, next week I'll actually be present for the recording of the Paleo Solution podcast.
Cool. We'll get something strength and conditioning oriented coming up soon. We need to get Mark Bell on the show. We've got Nate Miyake coming on here at some point. We have some other guests that we want to have on. It's just Greg's been really busy, and then with me and the bebe, it's frequently easier for Greg and I to just kind of fly by the seat of our plants, our pants, and find a block of time where we're like, okay, you're good, okay, I'm good, and we just kind of bang it out. Versus when we actually have a legitimate guest, we have to
actually, you know, live by
a timeline. Yeah, yeah. So
yes,
that's that cool story. But yeah, cool.
All right.
All right, well, man. Well, thanks.
All right. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. Later, G. See ya. Bye.